As many of you well know, there was some anticipation that the world would end on Thursday, or was it, I think it was Friday, early on Friday morning. I'm sure some of you saw the same cartoons that we saw, which was the five-day weather forecast that had on that day. The temperature was going to be 1,290 degrees, and there were meteor showers. It was just all the little same pictures, and then that one, and then there was nothing after that. Well, it didn't happen, for better or for worse. It doesn't mean that one of these days it won't happen, because these things do happen. Planets change, catastrophic events happen. We've already seen little pieces of it, but nothing that's really hit the whole globe. So here we are. We thought we'd plan Christmas anyway, just in case. It's like when my grandfather was dying. No, he wasn't dying. He just seemed really, really old to me. He was probably about my age now. A little child sitting on his lap, and he was doing the Jewish prayers, whatever they were. "Grandpa, do you really believe that?" I said to him. He said, "Well, I look at it like this." He said, "If I'm wrong, meaning after I die, I won't know it, and if I'm right, I'll be glad." Not a very solid basis for faith, which is why I'm no longer in the synagogue, you might notice. I'm here instead. But there is this reality that we're all facing at all times, which is trying to understand what it is that we really believe, where we're going, how we're going to get there. Paramahansa Yogananda came with this mission, and his mission was to show the parallel realities between the Bhagavad Gita, the primary scripture of India, and the New Testament primarily, the scripture of the West. Of all the passages, today appears on the surface to be the most contradictory, especially the way that phrase is understood. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes unto the Father except through me." Traditional interpretations of Christianity leave absolutely no margin for misunderstanding that. What could be more self-evident? If you've ever, as a self-realizationist, tried to have a conversation with someone who would call themselves a fundamentalist Christian, there's just like, how could it mean anything but what it means? Jesus Christ is the only way. Many of you have heard of the author Pearl S. Buck. She wrote most famously The Good Earth and a whole host of other books. And the first 40 years of her life was spent in China, some decades long before communism came in. And she wrote about China for the rest of her life. And what took her there was that her father was a missionary, a dedicated missionary, absolutely dedicated missionary. And I read a biography of her father. It was really a very interesting book. She described her father, you know, in many ways a great man because of the fearlessness with which he pursued his vocation as a missionary and the passion with which he went into it and the self-sacrifice, the utter disregard for personal comfort or personal well-being. Because of "I am the way, the truth, and the light," he believed with every fiber of his being that souls were condemned to hell unless they accepted Jesus Christ as their Savior. And as Pearl Buck wrote about it, that was a mighty burden for an individual to carry. Everybody that he saw, it was a question of whether they were damned for eternity or got to be with Jesus in heaven. So he dedicated himself with a zeal that did not make him a very good family man, but she admired him nonetheless for the passion with which he went at his work. And he was very famous in his field and very expansive in his thinking. He translated the Bible into Chinese dialects. He refused to live in the Anglo compounds where the other missionaries huddled, and he traveled among the people. So he really did it as well as he could possibly do it. Yogananda himself said that if the missionaries had also meditated, they would have made great spiritual progress because they were so selfless in the way they worked. And that selflessness came from this conviction of their personal responsibility, what had been given to them and what they had an absolute obligation then to share with others. It's interesting to me sometimes how incarnations form themselves around whatever the idea is, and reason follows feeling. Everything comes with that. But it's not necessarily a bad thing, because sometimes that unquestioning conviction is what gives you power to overcome the self. And the real purpose of all spiritual life is to overcome the small self. That's why Master said, even though the theology of these people may have been narrow according to truth and not in Dharma, the power of their conviction enabled them to live for a greater reality and suppress the selfish desires of the little self. I was amused in this respect. The Suzuki violin method, which is very well known now, in which children are, from the time they can cognize music at all, they're just trained up to play music as naturally as they breathe. A friend of mine who became quite good through that method said he could simply not remember a time in his life when he wasn't playing the violin. It was just always part of his existence. Well, Suzuki, I can't remember what his first name was, but it doesn't matter. Suzuki, the Japanese man who presented this, believed that anybody could learn to play beautiful music by the method that he had developed. And as a consequence, he absolutely refused to believe in reincarnation. Just firmly, with fanatical conviction, he denied the reality of reincarnation. And in many other ways, he was had a very expanded view of reality. But reincarnation would foil his system, because every child had to be equal and equally capable. And I was always amused by how the little blind spot was there, because it gave him passion for what he was asked to do, and he gave himself to that. And you forgive him these little ignorances. And I can imagine Master looking at missionaries whose lives were extraordinary examples of selfless dedication to an ideal, and just forgiving their little foibles, their little philosophical misunderstandings, because God does not read our PhD theses. That's not really how he decides whether we're going to get into heaven. What he reads, as Master put it so simply, was God reads the heart. What is the intention here? What are we really doing? What we call it is so much less important than what we're actually doing. Is our compassion without limit? Are we willing to put our time, our energy, our money, our comfort, you know, behind our idealism? Or do we just sort of wander around and have little thoughts here and there and then go back to protecting this small self? Recently, Swami Kriyananda has written a course of lessons that is being distributed through India on both meditation and philosophy. And as part of those meditation courses, he's written some affirmations for meditation, one of which is so beautiful to me and says everything about the spiritual path. May my heart's devotion to thee so absorb me that there is no place in my heart for any other love. May my heart's devotion to thee so absorb me that there is no place in my heart for any other love. Now, he doesn't mean that in our devotion to God, we disregard his creation or we disregard our fellow man. The place that there is no, the love that there is no room in our hearts for is the love of ourself, the love of our personal desires, love of all our little comforts, the love of being thought well of by people, of being appearing clever, of getting in and making sure that our system is in order before anybody else can get in and make it uncomfortable for us. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, it tells us, in whatever way you worship God, in that way God comes to you. And I was starting to say at the beginning, this is the apparent exact opposite of I am the way, the truth, and the light, whatever way you worship me. And Swamiji did not put them together to show that one was right and one was wrong. And that's why he raises the simple question, what is the I that we're talking about? And the whole misunderstanding, really, between self-realizationists and traditional Christianity is really all about that one letter, that one pronoun, that one letter. What was the consciousness of Jesus? When we speak of I, whether we're calling it that or not, we're defining our consciousness by the association that we have with that word. You know, somebody who says I could mean, you know, I'm a meat-eating, truck-driving, beer-drinking worker, and this is what I do. And if you speak to him of his infinite soul or his potential for kindness or his ability to learn to play the violin by the Suzuki method, he would just look at you like, how could I possibly do that? When he says I, it brings with it this whole picture. When a little child says I, it brings with it a certain picture. And we realize that when some people speak I, they're speaking more in a global sense. I am a world citizen is a common idea, or I am an American, or I am a European, or I am a Jew, or I am a Christian. We associate that pronoun with all of the identifications that have defined us, all the other loves besides the pure love of God. If we are so absorbed in the love of God, when we say I, we are that love and nothing else. But if there's room in our hearts for all these other loves, when we say that pronoun, they're all included. Last week when we were talking about this same topic, really, what is the state of a master, and Swami Kriyananda talked about when he would sit with Yogananda sometimes and just try to imagine what his consciousness was like. Swamiji says, we all naturally think that somehow it would have been better to have been able to be with Yogananda in person when he was in the body. But Swamiji said, in certain ways, it's easier to relate to him now that he's passed. He said, because it was so confusing. Swamiji talked about himself as a young disciple. He was fully aware on some level that Master's consciousness was one with the infinite, that he was a divine incarnation. He was a fully self-realized master. And yet he was next door having supper or going out for a drive or being interested in where the trees were planted. And he said it was sometimes it was just so confusing. And when he was sitting with Master in front of Master once, as he said, contemplating his consciousness, trying to go there, Master must have sensed it because he looked at Swamiji with a certain compassion and said simply, oh, if you knew my consciousness, if you really knew what it is to be in the state of cosmic awareness that is a master's natural reality. Yogananda recommended that we memorize and repeat the poem Samadhi. The quotes up on the wall are verses from that longer poem. That longer poem is available in Autobiography of a Yogi and Whispers from Eternity in printed form. I highly encourage you to do that, to repeat that poem, whether you've memorized it or whether you're just looking at the words. Because in that poem, Yogananda is defining the pronoun I when he uses it. When he talks about a tiny bubble of laughter, I have become the sea of mirth itself. The little self enters the great myself, colossal container I of all things made. The sparrow, the grain of sand, fall not without my sight. All space like an iceberg floats within my mental sea. You just sort of get some of those phrases from joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. And try to, just even with imagination, what to speak of actual realization, enter into that reality. Now, when Jesus was speaking exactly the same truth that all great masters for all time have spoken. He never genuinely asserted that what he offered was unique, except that it was unique in time and it was coming through in that moment. It was a particular message for those disciples at that time, for this planet in that moment, for the Jewish people because of their sincere longing. A master's consciousness is unlimited. All avatars have the same consciousness. But when they take human form, they willingly assume limitation, pain, and death, as we say in the Festival of Light, for the salvation of mankind. They choose to incarnate in a physical body. And then they become limited, not in their own consciousness, but in how they're able to express it. Because they're limited by the culture in which they live, the people they have come to serve, the disciples they've come to uplift. But the message is exactly the same. It is one of perfection. It is one of perfect bliss. It is one of absolute freedom. No matter how they express it, whether it's Krishna or Jesus or Buddha or Yogananda, from joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. And there is no other love in the heart of a master except the love for God and the desire to bring others to that same state of awareness. That which I do, Jesus said, ye shall do, and greater things. That very statement alone tells you that he was not talking about a unique reality of his own. He was talking about the reality of all of us, to all those who received him, to all those who were able to comprehend the gift that he was actually giving. So when he said, I, he didn't mean I, Jesus, and you poor saps, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, I am the way, I am the truth. From one point of view, it's supremely confining. But what he really meant is the consciousness in which I walk, the awareness of God, the joy that is my true nature, my union with the Father, and all that he is able to do through me. You can have that if you will receive from me the truth that I offer. And then the other side of it, the Bhagavad Gita is so sweetly balanced, and the two of them together make the perfect expression, the different ages in which the masters lived. The Bhagavad Gita is always giving us sort of our fallback position. Christianity, when Jesus came to speak, he came to the Jewish people, and it's a bit complicated, the Jewish people. It's a bit complicated what was going on at that time. As Swamiji put it, he said, so little of the true Sanatan Dharma brought by Moses. The Jewish faith does not look to Moses in the way they ought to look to Moses, because they don't understand modern Judaism, no longer understands even their own roots, which is Moses was a great avatar. And Moses came to the Jewish people when he came out of the sincerity of that karmic group to receive God in his full power. And Judaism was created through the revelation of Moses. But by the time Jesus reincarnated, the sincerity was still there because they drew the avatar. But as Swamiji said, there was so little understanding of Sanatan Dharma left, except probably among the Essene community, which is what Jesus was born into and where his mission emanated from, so they say. But otherwise, he had to fight so hard against this rigid consciousness. Bear in mind, it's Kali Yuga, deep in Kali Yuga, and getting worse. So that consciousness is very rigid, very materialistic oriented. Society as a whole is very unimaginative, and it's all going down from there. So Jesus had to put tremendous force into his own personality, his own person, his own incarnation, just to fight against that, because there was no broader understanding. And that's where all the misunderstandings have come from. Krishna, on the other hand, born into the tradition of India, in which it's well understood about the nature of avatars, that they come periodically, they uplift society, we know who they are, we understand what it's about. So Krishna could be so much more gentle. So in the Bhagavad Gita, he's so comforting. In whatever way you worship God, he says, God will come to you. So even though, from the point of view of self-realization, I can speak with extreme disinclination of a very narrow-minded interpretation of the true teachings of Jesus, nonetheless, it brought tears to my eyes to read about Pearl S. Buck's father and the passion with which he went forward and dedicated his life to the truth as he understood it. How could God be anything but pleased with such selfless service? And another book that I read was about an American woman who went with her missionary husband to New Guinea or someplace like that. I can't remember exactly where it was. But they went just before the beginning of World War II and ended up being captured by the Japanese. And her husband died, and she spent several years in a Japanese prisoner of war camp. She was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. And in the end, ended up converting this vicious guard, the captain of the camp. She ended up converting him to Christianity. And later on, he became a great spokesperson for the life of Jesus and a repudiation of all the cruelty of the war. How can you dispute on mere tiny philosophical grounds when you see such absolute nobility and courage and dedication, reading about this woman's faith in God and how that faith manifested in healings and near miraculous events and courage, you just think, oh Lord, I'll take that. If that's how I can get it, that's how I'll take it. But what we're really talking about is how profoundly and truly God works with each one of us. And even in the context of this church where we sit, people are often asking, you know, they want the rules. I got a letter from someone once, and it was asking me, the first question is the question I'm always asked. Can you tell me what the shortcut to self-realization is? All of this sort of day by day, two steps forward, one and a half steps back business is getting tiresome. Is there an easier way? So tell me what that is. It's sort of like when I was a child and I was absolutely convinced there had to be more meaning to life than what I saw around me. I really believed that the adults actually knew, and they were just waiting till I was of a certain age, and then they would tell me, and we'd all have a good laugh about the apparent meaninglessness of it all, and now it would all be settled. And I got older and older and older, and I began to realize that they didn't know. They weren't holding back on me. They just really didn't know. And that was a moment of quiet desperation, I think is what I would call that. It hit me my first week at Stanford. I'd sort of held out till I got to college. I thought, well, at a brilliant university, no. They were intelligent, but they were not wise. They really had no better idea than I did. So I did not graduate, let's just put it that way. But nonetheless, I often had the feeling that devotees, seeing older ones of us on the path, think that there must be a shortcut. So I get this question in a thousand different ways. Sometimes I'm patient with it, sometimes I'm quite impatient with it. You know, there's no way. You persevere. You got yourself into this mess by one wrong choice after another. We get ourselves into this by having a thousand other loves in our heart than God. And now that we kind of have a minor interest, do you think that you can just sort of pull out all those other desires just by the mere casual wishing, oh, I think I'll be different now? Not a chance. You know, we worked very hard to get here. We have to work very hard to get out of here. But once we're flowing with the current, it's a lot more pleasant, believe me, a whole lot more pleasant than the trouble we got into. Although, as Swamiji says, there's always a little pleasure mixed. I mean, why do people keep reincarnating? If, you know, even though there's so much misery on this planet, well, because there's a lot of pleasure too. You just have to wait till one outweighs the other, and there's just no way around it. But the other question this man asked me is that he wanted the rules. He wanted to know what the rules are. Okay, if it's going to be hard, then give me my map. In other words, I want a substitute for intuition. I want a substitute for personal responsibility. I want a substitute for self-understanding. I just want the rules. And that's a valid question and a valid stage of life. And there are certain self-evident principles that govern it, but there is no shortcut. Self-realization is exactly what it means. We ourselves must come to these understandings one by one. I've been on the path long enough now, I've known Swami Kriyananda long enough now to be quite amused by the cycle, having watched it so many times. I remember on the phone once, he had raised some idea and I was disputing him, and finally his patience came a little bit off. Asha, he said, you always agree with me in the end, why don't you just think about it? He said like that. And I thought, oh yeah, that's right, I do. It was a very timely remark for me. So when I have a tendency to dispute what he says, because we're all strong-minded here, I stop and think, well, I always agree with him in the end. And it's not that I give in to him. Don't misunderstand me. It's that when I really do think about it, I realize that he has a perspective that I don't have. And we don't get there by rules. I remember a man once was disputing with Swamiji about some point. They were in his house and the man was arguing this or that. And after he left, someone sort of expressed he was so, whatever the word was, rebellious. Oh, and Swami said, I prefer an honest argument anytime, he said, to a mindless yes. He said, a mindless yes takes you nowhere. It's just a matter of time before you're going to rebel against that. He said, go kicking and screaming every step of the way. Don't be pig-headed, which is different. But to be strong-minded because you really need to understand it yourself is the path of self-realization. There's no shortcut. Jerry Torgerson, who was one of Master's disciples, he was the one who had the idea at the desert retreat that he was going to replace the roof with a concrete roof or something like that and drove all the nails through the roof. And then it was pouring rain and the rain came through and they had buckets everywhere. And Jerry caused Master a certain amount of difficulty, and Jerry sort of said to Master, I'm sorry, I'm so stubborn, sir. And Master said, that's all right, I attract stubborn people. And in an oblique way, it's a compliment. Because if we don't have the power within ourselves to really know who we are, to know where we stand, to know what we believe, then sooner or later we're just going to get blown off course anyway. But then the Gita tells us so sweetly, in whatever form you worship God, God will come to you. And he didn't say that form will manifest. He said God will come to you because God reads the heart. He doesn't read the book titles on your shelf. He doesn't even read the cleverness that comes out of your mouth. He reads who we really are. When each one of us says, I, what are we referring to? Me and my selfish needs, the two or three people that I let into my world and let the rest of them rot. Make me comfortable, make me rich, make me powerful. Is that the I? Or even whether we're rich or powerful or pathetically weak, whatever it might be, who am I? Who reigns? What ideal lives in the temple of our hearts? What is our heart devoted to? How much place is there in it for all the selfish loves? Just don't sweat the small stuff. Christmas time is a wonderful time to realize that, because suddenly everybody's mind just turns in this other way. Master writes that at Christmas it's easier to feel God's presence because the whole world is infused with goodwill and with peace on earth. And he said, even in the higher realms, even in the astral worlds, they celebrate the birth of a great master. Isn't that something? Even the angels, they have a party, just like we have a party. And sometimes I think they're in the temple with us celebrating. I'm sure you've heard their voices when the choir sings and felt the flutter of their wings, so to speak. You just know that the sum total of what's happening is bigger than the people we can see. Because the whole universe is celebrating. And what are they celebrating? They're not celebrating this church or that church or anything like that. What God is celebrating is those who have turned their attention away from the selfish toward the bliss of the infinite. That's the way, that's the truth, that's the light. No one comes unto the Father except by that means. The Father is the power of God beyond this obvious world. And no one comes to him except by that kind of love, whatever form it takes. However you love, to that extent, God will bring that love back to you. This is the divine law. This is the promise of the birth of Christ. This is the season of Christmas. God bless.